Here, your character Issa has that access, but still, there's things beyond just the fix and the expense, like of the hearing aids. There's still a lot of adjustments to be made. I think that's very clear in the story.
I hope so, yeah.
Well, Hannah and Archie, again, many thanks for joining us today. I hope both of you stay healthy and safe. We've been talking with Hannah Lilith Asadi and Archie Obejas, contributors to the story anthology Take Us to a Better Place, published by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. You can learn more about Hannah and Archie, as well as all the contributors to the collection and their stories, and you can download a free copy of the ebook at rwjf.org/fiction. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Hannah and Archie for visiting us at KBOO, to the wonderful Aileen Boyle for getting us together, and to all of you for listening.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up is a special encore presentation of Black Book Talk from December 2011. The guest was Dr. Tabiti Lewis, author of Ballers of the New School, Race and Sports in America. Dr. Lewis was a guest speaker at the opening of Pride and Passion, the African-American Baseball Experience. This traveling exhibit was presented by the Multnomah County Library and told the story of black baseball players over the past century and a half.
Good morning and welcome to the December edition of Black Book Talk. I'm Patricia Welch, the library lady.
And Obie Hill of Reflections. Let's read, walk, and talk.
All right. And I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman. Good morning.
Good. And we are pleased to welcome to Black Book Talk Dr. Tabiti Lewis, the author of Ballers of the New School, which was published in 2010 by the Third World Press. And Dr. Lewis, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you very clearly. Welcome. You know, there's so much we want to talk about today. Of course, we want to talk about your book, but we want to talk about the NBA strike. We know you'll have some great insights about that. And also about a new exhibit that you're going to be introducing this weekend. But again, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about you and how you came to write the book and about your interest in sports.
Okay. Well, I am from St. Louis, Missouri, and as a kid in high school, person always was involved in sport, football, baseball, basketball, but also found that I had quite a love for literature and drama and really began to engage that interest in high school. And, you know, over the years, I think I sort of got unlucky in going to different sports programs at the wrong time and, you know, sort of just missed out participating. And it sort of kept me from getting too caught up into the sports factory. But I've always, you know, had an interest in just writing about and analyzing sport culture. And even as a young person, I was always bothered by the narratives that I would find myself listening to as I would be watching a football or basketball game. And so in writing this book, Ballers of the New School, Race and Sports in America, it is really a culmination of years of not only my interest in study of critical race theory in America, but my interest in sport and seeing how this particular arena, if you will, certainly has the potential to really make a difference in our society, but at the same time can reify particular stereotypes and ideas and, you know, and perhaps stagnate particular developments. So, but it's a great place to sort of engage these particular conversations around race and progress in our society because we live in such a sports crazy world, right? So I laugh at myself sometimes when I say, wow, I live in Portland, Oregon, which is the home of the major sports manufacturing company in the world, which is, you know, Nike, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really, life is very, very interesting in that way. But I came to the book, you asked me about it, interestingly enough, because of my interest in the Negro League, Negro Leagues. And when I was living in St. Louis, I had taken a trip, and I talk about this at the end of my book, to Kansas City, Missouri, just because I was at a black expo and had met a few old-timers, and, you know, I would read newspaper articles, and I said, I really want to write a book about sport and race in America. And I said, I think the place I need to start is really, outside of the reading I've been doing, is really going to Kansas City to see this museum. And in the book, I tell this story about passing the the previous Negro League building about 4 or 5 times before finally getting out of the car to say, wait a minute, that address has to be it has to be right here. And looking at this store plate window and seeing this cutout shadow of someone holding a bat, and just sort of going in and kind of saying, wow, this is the space. And so, you know, I kind of make this analogy of the invisibility of that building represents the invisibility of race in our society. So does that help?
It helps a lot. And you know something, I was going to ask you about it later, but since you've talked about baseball, could you tell us a little bit about this exhibit, this program that's opening up soon that you are involved in terms of being the opening speaker?
Yeah, the Pride and Passion exhibit is really great because it has a number of different themes that are part of it, and it covers the sort of history, if you will, of baseball and racial prejudice throughout the nation from 1860 to 1877. They have a component that's called Finding the Way in the Hard Times, and then there's another component from 1887 to 1819 that focuses on barnstorming on the open road, and 1920 to 1932 engages the notion of separate leagues and the parallel lives. So we get to see the first black baseball leagues, including the Negro League and the Eastern Color League, and how they fared until the Great Depression alongside of, you know, baseball itself. And then there's a component, 1933 to 1946, where we see the Negro League sort of revival after the Depression, and you see these very successful franchises like the Kansas City Monarchs and the Homestead Grays. And then, of course, the 1947, which is pivotal because this is the year that the color barriers in baseball are broken, and it's called the Signposts for Opportunity. So we see Jackie Robinson and, you know, joining the all-white Brooklyn Dodgers, and what that means, and sort of reminder to us that it took 12 years for all of the major league teams to, in fact, get black players, and you know, gives us a sense also of some of the very conditions that the black players endured, even while they were in spring training camps all the way up until the 1960s. You know, with the teams they were with, as far as separate and segregated housing and dining, et cetera, et cetera. And then it takes us into the present. And so, I will attempt to really, just as I do in my book, use sport, but more than anything, the Negro Leagues, in which to have this conversation around race in our society. And particularly near the latter component, where we have the sort of breakthrough with Jackie Robinson, on one hand, what that really represents in my mind more than anything is this sort of, breaking up, if you will, officially of the Negro Leagues, which, you know, I'm not romanticizing it. It had its problems and disorganization, but much of that was due to the very dynamics of race in our society that made it so difficult when you had this very popular and talented league that was, you know, sort of taking place with things like white owners overcharging them, you know, to play in the venue. You know, what is the price of the ticket, as James Baldwin would say, that that sort of made it difficult. So it is a great thing for young people to come to. I will attempt to be a bit less vociferous than I'm being right here.
When will you do that? When is your presentation?
It is this Saturday, December 3rd, at the Central Library downtown on 10th Street at 3 p.m. It is going to be a wonderful event. There will be a live jazz band. I will speak for no more than 15 or 20 minutes. The exhibit will be open. There will be games and trivia, and there will be stadium-style refreshments throughout. So it's a perfect venue for the young and the old and the curious.
Now, this is the opening of the exhibit, and it's going to last through January the 22nd of this coming year, so it should be real nice. Incidentally, I'd like to throw a little tip in here. Today is December the 1st. On this day in 1955, Rosa Parks decided not to give up her seat in Montgomery, Alabama, sparking what we call the Civil Rights Movement. Right, Doctor?
It certainly is one of the most well-publicized sparking of the civil rights movement. I like to think about the Greensboro youth and different women's groups, even prior to Rosa Parks, that were strategically instrumental in, you know, hatching out these plans of, you know, of really sort of pushing for, you know, social equity, if you will. You know, it's kind of amazing when we think about that, right? You think, you know, I always, when I'm lecturing to my students or even talking to my children, just the insanity of, you know, being able to sit on a bus, use the same restroom, eat in the same dining space. And so I always try to get people to reflect on, when I say insanity, the, you know, what is the mentality of those who would uphold, you know, such such practices. And, you know, because I feel like that's what needs to be the focus. Like, wow, there's something really kind of, you know, problematic and if not insane. And if we think of it that way, although it sounds harsh, you know, that kind of keeps those kind of practices from recurring, right? Hello? Did I get lost or am I speaking too radically?
No, you
radically?
Didn't. We're just waiting because we want our third member to have a chance to ask you a question, too.
Oh,
that's
okay.
All.
Certainly.
Thank you. I want to thank OB for doing a shout out. I am calling from Rosa Parks Elementary today. So December 1st is a big day at our school.
Fantastic.
So my question is, thinking about the Negro League and then coming forth after integration, after the teams were opened up, is there any difference in skill and showmanship?
So the Negro Leagues are existing prior to integration,
right,
because of segregation.
Right.
But I think your question is, but their movement into Major League Baseball is because of the immense talent that exists, and because of the curiosity and knowledge throughout you know, the country, that there are a lot of very talented ball players that are not getting an opportunity to play. So certainly, and they had to, I mean, many of the innovations that exist in modern baseball can be attributed to the Negro Leagues, you know, hit and run, the first under the lights games, the extravagance of the all-star games, which would take an entire week. And, you know, these remember, we live in a capitalist country, so the white owners, they were charging them immense fees because they were like, oh, wow, this is really something. And at the same time, they were taking a look at this talent. And so what the players did, which we see today, which I talk about in my book, Ballers of the New School, is an era of athletes who really focused on developing nicknames, personas that we see even today, right? So you had the kind of early Magic, you know, Irvin Magic Johnsons, the, you know, they created these sort of personas around them, people like, you know, Josh Gibson, Satchel Paige, you know, and so this put people in the seats. And, you know, I think it's also a large part of, you know, historically within black culture, right, this sort of expressivity and play within play. And so the Negro Leagues was had this sort of, you know, aura around it. So when I look at the integration, and tell me, stop me if I'm going too far, I always look at the fact that, you know, people give credit to Branch Rickey, which I don't think it should be completely taken away. But let's be very clear that, you know, he's seeing a stream of cheap labor because of the dynamics of race and segregation, and also immense talent, you know, immense talent at a cheaper price, you know. So you know, when that segregation occurs, it effectively breaks up, you know, the Negro Leagues, unfortunately, you know, which is good and bad, right?
Yeah.
Talking about immense talent and the price, we have to ask you about the recent the recent NBA, shall we say, contract negotiations, strike, whatever you want to call it. Just give us your perspective on this.
Wow. You know, yeah, I was going to chat about this a little bit. So I thought that...
yeah, that's how we feel too, Goody. Yeah. This is great.
I've been meaning to write about this, but I've just been so busy, and there's no excuse. You know, when I look at the NBA, first of all, the NBA contract negotiations, the first thing that's very unfortunate is that people forget that the players were locked out, okay? They're locked out. That means, you know, you can't work unless you agree to renegotiate your contract. So we're not going to let... So it's unfortunate that the owners, who are among the wealthiest people in our society, they have this particular, media control. And so, if you paid attention, you saw all of the publishing of how much money players were losing, how much money different players were losing each week. And so there's this sort of subtle, and in some ways over racial dynamic around these ungrateful, because the vast majority of the players in the NBA are African American, these ungrateful fellows, I won't use any harsh language, who 50% is not a good enough cut for them, or they're making, there was a 57% cut on the player's end. And so so even them continuing to sort of back down to take less and less, but it's funny. Someone was saying, "Oh, look, they're arguing over $4 billion." Well, let's look at it this way: you've got $4 billion being divided 50-50, so that's $2 billion being then divided up amongst about 450 players versus about 32 owners, right? Mm-hmm. And so those kind of dynamics are never kind of played out unless people like me kind of come in and say, let's do the cultural analysis and begin to look at, these particular dynamics. So the Negro Leagues are very instructive because you have people saying, okay, if you're not going to let us play, if we're going to be segregated out, then, we'll make our own league, And you mm-hmm. saw some players beginning to do these particular tours. And I think that was applying a little bit of pressure, right? Because, mm-hmm. This is an interesting dynamic whereby they are a large part of the product. You can't just say, oh, it's the Portland Trailblazers. They're promoting a particular star. And so therein lies the leverage. But some of the anger from fans is very racially codified and directed at the players. And they're angered at how dare they make this sort of money. And in my book, I talk about, but the anger in this sort of racial contract and social contract theory and privileging along the lines of race is never directed toward the owners and seeing them as greedy, So it's really interesting. I wish the players would have been smart enough to take advantage of the takeover Wall Street sort of impetus to say, while the numbers are larger, there's still this issue around, this sort of larger capitalist structure and those who are workers,
Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO. This is Black Book Talk, and we're talking to Dr. Lewis. Now, exactly what is a new school baller? I know... I know one thing that I really enjoyed, your letter to your cousin.
Oh, thank you.
But in that second chapter, you really get into some good definitions, and I'd like you to discuss and explain a little bit of that.
Yeah, what I was trying to articulate is that this sort of baller spirit is really reflective in what I see when I think about the Negro Leagues and someone like Andrew Rube Foster, who is an unreconstructed black man, and it doesn't have to just be a African-American man, but he's this unreconstructed figure that says, I'm not going to allow this segregation to stop me from being involved in baseball, and that, okay, there's a hurdle, but we can create a league on our own and do this against all odds. And so then at the same time, such a person, I'm hoping, also has a particular political consciousness and understands the importance of utilizing particular platforms that they have to, when I say unreconstructed, is to say, I'm going to stand on principles and what I'm about despite the repercussions. And so, when I think of Muhammad Ali, I don't think of the sort of reconstructed persona that sports writers now sort of laud now that he's, ironically silent. But I think mm-hmm. of this individual who says, here I am at the peak of my game, and I'm going to take a particular stand based on what my principles and morals are about. Or someone like John Carlos, or and that's why I have a section where I have old school and new school ballers, and I try and say that contemporary athletes and people who are non-athletes, it's important to look at and need to look at the examples of people like, Jim Brown, Althea Gibson, people like Billie Jean King, people like Martina Navratilova, not Navratilova, who are, who say, I'm just going to kind of step out here and, and stand on who I am. And so I'm challenging also, I'm really trying to challenge this contemporary generation of athletes to imbibe the sort of hip-hop idea of, you know, doing you, right?
Right.
And keeping it real. And I'm saying this is what it means to keep it real. And so they're conflicted in this sort of, on one hand, they're a corporation and they're kind of, you know, being fed what to say and sort of kowtowing in some ways because of their corporate interests and because they are corporations in and of themselves. But they must not forget that, you know, we are still in an era where we are not post-race yet. So I'm trying to hit all these different tenors at the same time, you know. And so that would be my engagement of a baller being this sort of unreconstructed figure that has a certain political consciousness and you know, et cetera, at least those particular components.
Is there another book in the making?
Well, I do have a book that probably is far less popular culture driven that is coming out in March. It is an edited book. It's called Conversations with Toni K. Bambara, who is the unbelievable black feminist writer who wrote one of the first and most important anthology of black women writing called The Black Woman. And I just had, it's a compilation of interviews with her, and I sort of talk about, you know, who she is. So that's, people go, but the other book I'm working on is a book that deals with what is performed regarding race and heroism and masculinity in American sport museums. And again, the Negro League Museum was part of the impetus behind that because it's attempting to fill a particular gap. But I've been traveling around to different major sport museums, football, baseball, basketball, and literally examining what is being performed, the agriculture, the architecture, and the design of these particular venues, and sort of interviewing the curators and, you know, all this stuff, and then beginning to kind of tell a narrative history around these spaces and what they're supposed to tell us and what they normalize for us in our society. So, so you know, that's the other book, is dealing with sport museums. Yeah.
So if one finds themselves in Indianapolis, what should we be looking at in the museum or looking for?
In Kansas City. You're saying in Kansas City for the Negro League Museum? Is that right?
No, I was talking about the sports museums that are in Indianapolis.
Oh, well, I know they have a, there is a, in Indianapolis, you have the, there's a, the collegiate museum, but I'm focusing on professional sport museums.
Okay.
And I'm particularly focusing on football, baseball, and basketball because I see those as the, like, high revenue, high interest sort of sport. I will talk in general around stuff like, you know, tennis, golf, boxing, you know, those kinds of things. Of course, hockey's museum is in Canada, so I'm looking at sport museums, particularly American sport museums. But in general, when you go to any sports museum, let's just say any sports museum, it's important to just kind of stand back for a second and really pay attention to the very architectural structure itself and the design. Because, you know, one of the things in my own study of architecture that, you know, you don't think about, but every space is constructed for you as a person entering it to have a particular experience. It's not just there wontonly. And that experience is supposed to be guiding you to see history in a particular way and feel a certain way about, you know, different individuals. So, for example, when you go to the Cooperstown, one of the first things that you see regarding baseball history are these huge things of, you know, you probably can guess it, Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, all these particular figures. And what is absent from that is the fact that no one kind of really gets into, hey, wait a minute, there's an asterisk besides this because it's kind of a steroid era. And what I mean by that is a racial steroid era, right? In that they're not competing against all of the best players. And so there has to be an asterisk next to those individuals, right? Not until after around 1970 when you've got this kind of more full integration. And then those players that emerge as the greatest because of the, you know, level competition, then you really see who's great. And so you have people like Ken Griffey Jr. and Hank Aaron. And you think, wow, these should be the individuals that are like the first thing you see. But what it does is maintain a particular nostalgia around Babe Ruth as the greatest ever, when in fact, at this point, I think he's like number three on the home run list, you know. So so again, we have these very kind of subtle racial narratives that take place. Am I going too far query here?
No, we'll stop you. Okay. But now I do have another question. There's a film called The Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars that's a part of the programming for this Pride and Passion exhibit, and as a matter of fact, a part of the exhibit will be at the North Portland Library, as well as the other part at the main library, and also this film is being shown at the North Portland Library next Tuesday. But I am curious, it's a fictional, you know, piece of cinema, Billy Dee Williams and James Earl Jones and Richard Pryce, so you know, it's comic, but I want to know, was this based on some particular players or some particular teams, if you are familiar with the film?
No, I am. As a kid, this is one of my favorite films, and I was probably watching it sooner than I should have been able to, right? Because
yes, because I've seen the film. If you were a kid, no, it's
but
perfectly
when you talk
fine
about
for
my
family.
Own work, that particular film has a huge impact on my interests. So the film takes bits and pieces of different histories around the Negro Leagues, and of course, you know, there are some exaggerations and just, you know, some fictional components. But one of them is when Satchel Paige takes a group of Negro League All-Stars, and in fact, to Cuba, and they do this sort of barnstorming, what have you, and they say, he almost destroyed the Negro Leagues, you know, because all the star players were gone, right? So you're already dealing with this sort of racial strife that's sort of pressing you economically, and then you've got star players that decide they're going to, you know, go and because, you know, it's about money, right? And so the players are being exploited on each end, so, you know, they're barnstorming abroad. And so this takes on that particular component from the standpoint of, you know, just them breaking away and, you know, sort of competing within the U.S. against the league owners, right? And then it ends with this sort of, at the end when they finally decide to give them a team, well, lo and behold, what has happened, the kid who is really Jackie Robinson, if you will, gets a chance to go to the majors, right? And so it's like, oh, now we've got our own team, but, you know, our days are numbered. And so it kind of has this bittersweet kind of engagement. What I didn't like, though, I think it made the owners out to be these real villainous figures more so than they were. I mean, you know, honestly, the truth is that the Negro Leagues gave a lot of kind of people like Cum Posey and others, kind of number runners and hustlers, this sort of legitimate business opportunity to, you know, owning teams, you know, and you know, kind of gives the underworld an opportunity to own teams, which I think takes place in the major leagues as well. It's just not as publicized or visible, right? Whether you're stealing stocks or doing something else, running booze to acquire wealth and you're able to buy a team, or you're kind of someone like, you know, Cum, who's kind of running numbers, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a fun film. I think people should really go and check it out. I hope I didn't see that there's a discussion after it, but there should be. It's good for discussion along the exhibit, and kind of saying, oh, I see where some of this is taken from historical stuff, and some of that's from historical to construct this fiction. Yeah.
Good.
Well, mentioning time in a discussion further, we're going to have to be taking up this discussion a little bit later. But remember, we will always be looking toward new school ballers. And this is Black Book Talk. I'm O.B. Hill.
I'm Patricia Welch.
And I'm Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
And we thank you, Dr. Lewis, for joining us. And we invite everybody out here to just enjoy all of the wonderful things that are going to be happening in the upcoming month in terms of books and literature and programming. And we'll see you in January.
Okay, thank you for having me. This was a great pleasure. It really was.
Thank you.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never go back. Go to the root, 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 root.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Hoy jueves 7 de mayo del 2020.